I've been thinking a lot about, like probably many of us have, the state of our world, the state of our country, all of the tumult that is happening, the pain, the violence, the injustices, and I don't have an answer. You know, I don't come to you as any kind of somebody who really knows, but I come to you tonight to talk about how our practice can meet difficult times and how our practice specifically of vipassana, of clear seeing what that opens up. So I want to dive in a little bit to these basic practices of what does it mean to look deeply and to see what is going on. But first, as a way to ground all of that discussion in the reality of our lives, the reality of what is happening, I came across this piece from the writer Maxine Hong Kingston, and she said, in a time of destruction, create something, a poem, a parade, a community, a school, a vow, a moral principle, one peaceful moment. That was so encouraging to me, that in a time of destruction, it matters to create one peaceful moment. And all of these peaceful moments that we are creating together add up. They add up to something. It really matters. So again, she said, in a time of destruction, create something, a poem, a parade, a community, a school, a vow, a moral principle, one precious, peaceful moment. And if we each do that in our own way, because there isn't one way to do that, it gets pretty diverse. You know, there are a lot of ways that this can happen. And it's part of the commitment to Sila, to our true commitment to emotional intelligence, social intelligence, ethical intelligence. And Edie Hillesum, you might remember her, she was a brilliant Dutch writer in the Holocaust. She said, ultimately, we have just one moral duty, to reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves, more and more peace, and to reflect it towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will also be in our troubled world. I choose to hang my hat on that. I take that very seriously. And to bring in what Bill just said about the practices of generosity, to cultivate peace in our own being and offer it out is an act of generosity. And it's a reciprocal relationship. We do change things by our actions, by our energy, how we present. So I guess I'm just saying that because it's hard. It's really a tough time in this country in so many ways. And each one of us making a choice to be still and to let things settle, to create this clearing, to hold ourselves with cupped hands. I love that image. It is a beautiful practice, and it matters. It really matters. So whatever you do, whatever your choices are, how you participate as a citizen in your life, wherever you are, to know that your choices matter. And so when you make wholesome, wise, kind choices, they may be different from mine or different from your neighbors or different from your partner, but that's great because we need a variety. In fact, the Buddha said, whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this way like the moon in the path of the stars. That is one of my favorite teachings, because it honors our different ways of being. He didn't say there's only one way to do this. And over again, ehi passiko, right? Encouraging investigation. Learn from your own direct experience. Whatever path of action you find that brings good and happiness to all, follow this path like the moon in the path of the stars. And sometimes paths of action can be hard to find or to stick with, or it might be confusing. What do I do in the face of so much suffering? And this, of course, is the path of the Bodhisattva. How do we train, and we are training as Bodhisattvas, to meet the suffering that is everywhere? Every single time we sit down to steady ourselves, we are strengthening this commitment. So I watched I don't know if it was a documentary, a short film last year that I came across again today as I was thinking about what I wanted to share with you. There's a man who is a former American Marine. His name is Nathan Schmidt, and he's the founder of a foundation called the Mountain Seed Foundation, and it's a camp of climbers for widows of the war in Ukraine. And what he does is he offers a week of challenge for mothers and their children in the Austrian Alps to mend their broken hearts from all of their losses. And so that's his path of action, right? To say, okay, I can use my skills as a mountain climber to recognize the pain that is around, and I'm going to help these people heal. And this is what he says about it. You must be able to bear your own sorrow. Even if it seems to crush you, you will be able to stand up again. For human beings are so strong, and your sorrow must become an integral part of yourself. You mustn't run away from it, but bear it. Do not relieve your feelings through hatred. Do not seek to be avenged on the other side, for they too have their own sorrow for their own losses. Give your sorrow all the space and shelter in yourself that it is due. Your cupped hands. For if everyone bears his grief honestly and courageously, the sorrow that now fills the world will abate. But if you do not clear a decent shelter for your sorrow, and instead reserve most of the space inside of you for hatred and thoughts of revenge, from which new sorrows will be born for others, then sorrow will never cease in this world and will multiply. Isn't that beautiful? The invitation to make space for our sorrow. And I think the piece that really struck me, I've read this so many times and something else happens for me each time I read it. Do not relieve your feelings through hatred. And we know this, but what I think is so interesting about his language choice, to relieve a feeling, right, is to discharge the energy of a difficult feeling. Because if I can relieve my negative, difficult, unskillful feelings in a way that causes more harm, all I've done is basically gotten it off my chest, but it still is residing in me. It sort of gets it off my chest and it just spreads it out. So you know the teaching of the two arrows. And we can find, who knows what this person's spiritual background is, whether he has studied teachings of the Buddha or not. But we know that with all of the violence and hatred and sorrow that is in the world, our practice of cultivating a peaceful moment is crucial. So that was a really long way of saying, this is really good that we're doing this. This is really, really important. Annie, did you have a question? I want to come back to you.
Well, I think now I have a bunch more because that's quite a daunting task for mm-hmm. me. Anyway, I the original question I don't recall. Oh, Well, I just loved your poem, and I guess this is being recorded, so we can go back and hear the name Postlethwaite or whatever.
Sure. And you know what? I'll put it in the chat before we finish.
Thank you. And Maxine Honks Kingston, and then what was the gentleman you were just
His name is Nathan Schmidt. You can look him up when you hear them. Yeah.
I can remember that. Okay. So yeah, right now nothing is coming to me as a real question.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know. I could share my experience and around what you're talking about, but maybe not.
Okay.
Maybe later.
Hang on to it. Okay, yeah. Maybe later. So is what I'm saying making sense to you about the necessity and the value of these peaceful moments? Okay, good. Good. So I was meeting with somebody the other day, a fellow practitioner, and she said, you know, it seems like I'm always at square one with this practice. I'm always coming back to my body. I'm always coming back to my breath. I have to manage my mind all the time. And then these different heart feelings come up. And am I ever going to figure it out? Am I ever going to get past just being with my body and being with my breath? And I can see you smiling. And I thought, you know, no, maybe not. And it's not like these basic beautiful teachings are enough. We don't have to move into thinking that we're at meditation 101 and then 2.0 and 3.5 and 10.9 or whatever it is. Because you remember when the Buddha said, in this fathom-long body, all the teachings can be found. We don't have to make it more complex to come into a very intimate relationship with greed and ill will and delusion and its opposite, the freedom of greed, from greed, right? Generosity and compassion and those moments of seeing more clearly. So this practice of vipassana, you know, vipassana, as you know, is often translated as mindfulness, but more specifically, clear comprehension, clear seeing. Sometimes the word sati is also translated as mindfulness, but I learned from Bhikkhu Anālayo, contemporary Theravadan monk, that sati actually more accurately translates as a soft receptivity of mind and heart. That changed practice for me, a soft receptivity of mind-heart. And it is the quality of mind that is necessary to cultivate in order for the mindfulness to arise. And that too is, I think, a very important, subtle and not subtle distinction about what is it that is arising here? What is it that knows? What am I aware of? And I know from my own experience that when I have agitation, fear, a difficult mind state, a difficult, tight heart state, I'm not receptive, or I'm a lot less receptive. That soft receptivity kind of goes away. It's not as available to me in those sorts of states of agitation. And therefore, it's harder for the mindfulness to be as present. But the more I practice these basics, and I don't think they're so basic. I think that this is such a beautiful and rich practice of being in my body, noticing the breath coming and going. I guided you through the senses and the elements, and there's so much to be learned from being present with the senses and elements, because one can learn the truth of impermanence, the truth of dukkha, the truth of one breath leads to the next, that everything is connected to everything. And you know, Thich Nhat Hanh so beautifully says that mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. It means seeing and knowing what's going on. But if we come all the way back to that piece from Thich Nhat Hanh, mindfulness allows us to look deeply. Well, what that says to me right away is I have to be in a state that I can do that. I need to this sati to be present, which is why I need to settle the mind and be still and just be with this breath so my nervous system can settle, so my mind can settle, so my heart can open. To me, it's pretty practical. I don't think that this is rocket science. I think this is very, very practical and not easy, and we all know that, that it takes doing this over and over again. But this peace, mindfulness, allows us to look deeply. You know, I think that to look deeply, to see and know what's going on, takes courage, doesn't it? It takes courage to be willing to say, wait a minute, can I pull back the layers of my belief systems, my opinions, my judgmental mind, my fears? And sometimes yes, and sometimes no. But we come back over and over to this, which I do believe does develop courage. Because every time we peel back a layer and we say, oh, hello me, what is here? Sometimes it's uncomfortable and sometimes it's not. And we train in being with discomfort. That is what we're training in. The whole practice of Vedana, pleasant and unpleasant and neither one, but where does it take us in the mind and the heart and what we do and what we say? So when this friend, practitioner said to me, I'm never getting past the basics. Am I ever going to learn anything else? And I sort of thought, I don't really think it's so basic. I think this is such a rich practice, and let's not judge it as, oh, I should be further along than I am. Because there's that comparing mind, right? That we have this mind of mastery. I taught another class this morning, and I brought in this poem and this line of, do not try to save the whole world or do anything grandiose. Another practitioner said, you know, I got the messaging that said, unless it was huge and grandiose, it wasn't worth doing. It's the small things. It's the showing up. So knowing that this practice of Vipassana and Sati are beautiful. They're beautiful and they're enough. They're enough because it is true that we can come to know the reality of the Four Noble Truths right in that, to look deeply and see what is going on, suffering and the end of suffering. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness, said the Buddha. And so then we come into these other instructions that I love so much, and this comes from Pema Chodron in one of her books. She said, you know, there are basically three instructions that we need in our lives. One, become fully present. Two, feel your heart. And the third, engage the next moment without an agenda. That's hard. Engage the next moment without an agenda. Who doesn't have some sort of agenda? I've been thinking a lot about agenda lately. But to become fully present, that goes all the way back to intention, attention, attitude, what's happening in the body, the state of mind and heart. So you can see how the whole Satipatthana Sutta, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of pleasant, unpleasant, mindfulness of the mind, thoughts, and emotions, and then mindfulness of experience in all the different ways. That's what is required to become fully present. And then it sets the, not just the tone, but the circumstances, hopefully the safety for the heart to show up, that the heart can reveal itself. Friendliness, metta, compassion, joy, gratitude, forgiveness, empathy. And metta has been a very important practice for me and transformative. And I don't ask why anymore. Why is this practice of metta so transformative? I'm just doing it because I know it's changed me. And sometimes it's helpful to let the mystery of how practice works inside of us to just let it work. Because maybe like me, you know something good is happening. And it doesn't mean I'm not going to fall down and blow it and course correct and need to apologize for saying something snarky. I will. I will. But this practice is so reliable. Another person in another class the other day said, you know, I've been off doing so many other things lately, and my formal sitting practice just hasn't been with me. And I'm coming back to this class now, and I realize the practice has always been with me. It just looked different. And I can trust that this practice will be here. And we can. And there's so many of us who are here tonight who've been doing this a long time. And we keep coming back because something good is happening. So that instruction that I gave you in the meditation about strong back, soft front, let the heart have space to breathe, that comes from Roshi Joan Halifax, and you may have heard her give that instruction. And there's so much in that. This posture of dignity and integrity sets us up for seeing more clearly every time we come and we sit and we're more steady. So I heard this story. I have no idea if it's true, but I'll share it with you. In a small area of Appalachia, there's a coroner there who works in conjunction with a piper, a man who plays the bagpipes. So when somebody dies in, it's a big county in these tiny little towns in somewhere in Appalachia, when somebody dies who doesn't have family, who doesn't have friends, and the coroner is responsible for making sure that this person is buried properly, he arranges the burial, and then he calls the piper, who goes to the graveside of people who are unknown to others and plays Amazing Grace as they are buried. And it's been going on for a long time, and it's his relationship with the coroner, and they do this together. This is their Donna, their way of caring for people who have died who have nobody to care for them. So a man had died, and the coroner called up the piper and said, this is going to be a little bit different because where this person is being buried is not where you've been before. It's a little bit far away, and it's kind of circuitous to get there. So here are the directions, and please write them down. And this is when the burial is, and give yourself some extra time to get there. So the piper said, yeah, sure, good, and wrote the instructions down, but as it turned out, got lost on the way to the burial. And as the time he was getting later and later, and he was going to miss, thought he was going to miss the moment, he was feeling more and more anxiety about, oh my God, I'm not going to be there, I'm going to be late, and you know how that feels. It's uncomfortable. Finally, he got to where he was going, and he could see up on a hillside, there were some people who looked like they were the grave diggers, and there was a hole, and there were piles of dirt, and he said, okay, great, good. Parked the car, got his bagpipes out, trudged up the hill, and he said, wait, please don't start filling this in yet. I'm here to play for this person. Can you just wait? And they said, yeah, okay, sure. So the piper began to play Amazing Grace. And he played and he played and he played from his deepest, deepest place. And it was so moving that he himself had tears. And the people who had dug the hole also had tears. And when he finished playing Amazing Grace, one of the men who had dug this hole said, in all of my years putting in septic tanks, I've never seen anything like this. Clear seeing, right? How does agitation trip us up and we get lost and we don't see what's actually going on? Isn't that just a great story? So I don't know what happened to the piper, but you know, it just, it's one of those things when we really, when the agitation is up, pause, When you get lost going somewhere, pause. And if you're using the GPS on the phone and it says redirect, 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 you do that in your own mind, right? How do we redirect the heart, the GPS that is internal? I actually really love that story. So then, you know, it comes, if we take where we've been about talking about the very real pain that is in this world and ways to meet it, to trust that our practices of sitting still, having a little quiet, really do matter. And we can see how the truth of impermanence is true, how dukkha works inside, and that because everything is connected to everything else, it really matters what we do. It really, really matters what we do. And that's not to set us up to be walking on eggshells. Don't do that. You can trust who you are and what you're doing. But in those choice points, those moments of, oh, do I want to do this or do I not want to do this? Pause and use your practice to actually take a breath, to take a breath. Here's another story for you. This is from Ram Dass's, one of his last books called Polishing the Mirror. Did anybody read it? It's a very sweet book. It's a little story anecdote. An older man is walking down the street and he hears a voice saying, "Psst, could you help me out?" And he looks around, but he doesn't see anybody. And again, he hears, "Psst, can you help me out?" And he looks down and there's a big frog and he's embarrassed. I mean, you don't talk to frogs, but he says, "Did you speak to me?" And the frog says, "Yeah, could you help me out?" "Well, what's the problem?" said the man. The frog said, "I'm under a curse. If you pick me up and kiss me, I will turn into a beautiful maiden and I will serve you and cook for you and warm your bed and I will be everything you ever wanted." And the man stood there for a little while, and then he picked up the frog and he put it in his pocket and he walked on. And after a while, the frog said, "Hey, you forgot to kiss me." And the man said, "You know, at my age, I think it's more interesting to have a talking frog." So here we are again with these choice points. The beautiful, enormously important practice of seeing clearly, of being willing to question, ehipasiko, find out for yourself. What are the causes of the three poisons, the three toxins of greed, ill will, delusion, and what are the causes of my release? When my mind subsides, my heart opens, and I actually make a different choice. So stay curious and avoid impulsivity. You don't have to kiss the frog, right? I mean, you can pause and reroute. All of this is in the service of cultivating wisdom, right? That deep felt sense of yes, no, I don't know, maybe. Who can I ask? How can I get some help? And I think that what we're doing, and then I want to pause and let's talk with each other. I love this very basic and beautiful, simple teaching from Norman Fisher, who said, "Strengthen your ability to face with love whatever happens next. Strengthen your ability to face with love whatever happens next. Whether you kiss the frog or not, whether you play Amazing Grace for a septic tank or not. When you get it a little bit sideways, okay." So we cultivate these beautiful practices of the heart, tenderness and openness of the mind, the vipassana, the sati, and we have access to our wisdom that's already here, that is already here. So what do you think? What do you think? Let's just talk with each other. Yeah, Mary, please.
So thank you so much.
You're welcome.
There's so many really sweet bits. And the one thing that came to me was a part of my practice, and it fits in with what you're saying. And it made me really think about how I could play with it. So when I do my meditation, I think people who know, it's like getting present and just wanting to have what my intention is going to be for clear seeing and wholesome intentions. And then I realized that I needed to have the how.
Yeah.
And for me, the how is to do it with patience,
mm-hmm.
and to do it with resolve. And what you were talking about with one of your students said, is to have resolve that it's okay to start over.
Huh, exactly.
It's like every moment. It's like, I mean, I'm constantly realizing that I need to, you know, feel my body.
Yeah.
Notice my breath. And the quality of patience for me is very much a heart quality.
It is. It is a heart quality.
Well, and that it's like meta for myself and meta for others, but it's just, and I love what Bill had said. There's a quality of generosity in that too.
There is.
All kind of together. And to just have that be a constant reminder as I move through my day, I have to say the person that frustrates me the most is me.
Well, yes.
You know,
I think the Dalai Lama even said, I am the cause of my own suffering, of my, yes.
And so I think that it's really important to have that. And then you've got to have a sense of humor. I mean, those are all kind of tied in together. So a little bit of patience, some resolve, and a sense of humor. She's just kind of like, okay, sweetheart, you know?
Yep.
And just, you know, move forward. So, yeah. So thank you. Well, your talks tonight and the things that you've read just all brought those to the forefront for me. And so I really appreciate that. Thank you.
You're welcome. I really also appreciate you saying, all right, I get what we're doing, but I need to know the how, right? Because otherwise it becomes just a cognitive idea. It's like, oh, that sounds like a great idea. Fine. But how am I supposed to do that? And so if we take any part of practice and look at it from, here's maybe a four-part framework to think about, is that you can understand what we're doing. You understand cognitively what it means to clear the mind, to settle, to all these aspects of practice, and we can read about it. You know, we can get it in that way. But until it's experienced, it's in the experiencing of, oh, I sat down, I was with my breath. I actually was with my breath for 5 breaths before I went to the grocery store. And then I came back and I did another 3 breaths, and then I was doing the laundry. And then I came back. This is the how of it, right? And then pretty soon you might get 10 or 15 breaths. Or you forget about the breath, but you're present. You're actually not at the grocery store or doing the laundry. You're actually right here in the body. And so then it goes from understanding to experiencing. And then in that experiencing, there's something that often happens, which I think is the thing that brings us back, is it becomes meaningful. Oh, I feel better. Oh, I didn't say that thing. Oh, I have more stability in my life. I'm less agitated, less judgmental. And through that process over and over again, there's a way in which this presence becomes embodied. The practice becomes embodied. And I think you can count on that. And my guess is you already know it, because you know to keep coming back and come and do this, the value of it. So remember that you can study anything, but we need to experience this and to understand why it matters. And then it really gets woven in. I'm really glad you said that, Mary. The how of it, so important. Patty and then Deborah.
Thank you so much for that talk.
You're so welcome.
The image of the cupped hands really touched me.
Yeah.
Today I learned Well, I'll start at the beginning. In the early 90s, I went on a tour group to Costa Rica, a vegetarian tour of Costa Rica. And one of the participants became a good friend of mine. And over the years, we stayed in touch, normally only two or three times a year. But when we went to New York, we'd spend time with him. When he came to the Bay Area, we'd spend time with him. And then whenever a Jewish holiday came, he would call and wish us happy Passover or happy New Year. This year, we didn't hear from him. So I called him and found out his line was disconnected.
Uh-oh.
I did a Google search and saw his obituary.
Oh.
And when you talked about the bagpiper going to the grave of people who don't have anyone to mourn them, he had a lot of friends, but his sister died before him. I don't know who his cousins are. I had no way to reach his family.
No.
I had no way to reach anybody. I made a contribution in his memory to the organization that was mentioned in his obituary. But I wanted to connect with someone else who cared for him and wanted to share my stories and my grief. And the cupped hand image was a reminder to hold myself in compassion and to keep my heart open, even though it's broken.
Yeah.
And it was a beautiful image. And I'm reminded to take care of myself.
Yeah. That's
and
right.
And I thank you for that image. And also for that hilarious story about the septic tank. That was brilliant. Thank you.
Oh, Patty, I'm sorry for your loss of your friend of so many years, and that's how you found out. You know, that's how you found out. And I do think that these connections are so critically important that we make over the course of our lives. Where did Patty go? I'm just missing. There you are. Okay, good. When the squares change, like these connections are really important. And to know he's going to call over Rosh Hashanah every year. Uh-oh. Yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm really sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Deborah.
I'm kind of hesitant because unfortunately I missed some of what you were saying. I was having computer trouble the last couple of days. Anyway, it always blows my mind. First of all, I'm so happy to see you again.
Thank you.
Glad to have you back with us. One of our members has recently, a week ago, moved to Colorado, and she's hoping to be able to connect with you perhaps in person.
Good.
So that aside, I had a similar thing that Patty just mentioned. When my older cousin in England didn't send me a Jewish New Year card this year, and I knew she wasn't well, and her husband just died, and she's in her 80s, and she's in another country, and it freaked me out.
Huh.
And I always tell my friends in their 80s and 90s to give my information to whoever, their children or grandchildren, nieces or nephews. It's just a fact of life now.
Yeah, isn't it?
I'm older, and other people are older,
yeah,
and we're far away. We're just far away. But it always blows my mind how I tune in. This used to happen to me decades ago when I would go to Al-Anon meetings. Whatever I needed to hear, that's what the topic was.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with coming to Sangha on Sunday mm-hmm. nights.
Mm-hmm.
I was having some things with a cousin recently, and I had to choose between saying nothing again. Decades of saying nothing again, to not rock the waters and to be kind and to be polite. And I finally thought, well, what about me?
Mm-hmm.
Can I find a way to let her know my values, thoughts, feelings, needs, blah, 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 blah? You know, what are my intentions here? Just
good question, right? Good question.
Yeah, what, you know, really, there's a part of me that wants to blast her out of the water, but I'm not going to feed that wolf, you know, I'm not going to mm-hmm. feed that one. And how can I, what Patty said just now also, how can I take care, and I've been listening to Richard Schwartz, Dr. Richard Schwartz, Internal Family Systems, you probably have heard of him, and all the different parts inside of us. Now, how can I put all that together with kindness and mutual respect and take care of myself and be honest? So I'm still struggling with that.
That is a huge practice, Deborah.
Thank you.
It is a huge practice, and there's not an easy answer, but I'm glad that you're actually saying, hey, wait a minute, what do I need here? What do I need? And so if you can sit with that, you don't have to know tonight, you don't have to know next week. Seriously.
I've been responding to her written, we're texting. This is another thing, to have a relationship in text with somebody who lives 45 minutes away. It's insane. But anyway, but what you said something, I can't remember now because my mind is leaving me, but how can I take care of my needs and be respectful? I mean, she's 86 years old or 85 years old. And how she doesn't go to therapy or Dharma or 12 steps, or she doesn't take nonviolent communication class. I mean, she's not doing that. So how can I be kind to myself and kind to her? But the other important thing, and then I'll stop talking, is what about the consequences?
Well, that's the thing that's going to guide you. If you look at your intention and then look at what are the potential consequences, and then I think you will know whether or not it's necessary to do anything about it.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Heidi. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
And so hello, Liz.
Here.
Go ahead and unmute, Liz. Can't hear you yet.
Looks like you've moved into your permanent house in Colorado.
No, it's not.
No.
No, this is, I'm house sitting for a friend.
Oh, okay. In any case, I want people to know that they can save the transcript. Not only can you watch the talk again, but if you go to captions, one of the choices is view full transcript. And at the bottom of the transcript, it says save transcript. So you can save any transcript, hopefully, and on most Zoom programs. And then read it again, because sometimes I prefer to read it than watch the tape, the video.
Great suggestion.
Yeah, so the other thing I want to say is pain. We respond to pain as if it's of evil. We're going to feel pain. Pain is a normal feeling. And I always used to say that in my early years of therapy, I never heard that's normal. And I didn't hear that's normal until I came to Buddhist practice. It's normal to feel pain.
Well, that's what dukkha is. That's the dukkha, right? That's the inherent part of being human is that we are going to feel pain. We are going to experience.
But it also means that we care. Very often the pain is a response because we care.
Correct.
And totally and not to wipe it out, but
that's
how
right.
Do you tolerate the pain? And for me, late in my life, I discovered self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, metta. Metta is one of my basic, I consider metta self-compassion. But the whole idea of self-compassion. But I believe we need to tolerate pain. I just sent out a message to the group about Asheville, North Carolina. Donald Rothberg just got back from Asheville, North Carolina. He had to stop a retreat. And they're doing amazing work down there. It's painful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not to wipe out the pain. The pain means you care. Yeah. And then and celebrate that you care.
Yeah, that's right. So it's about the relationship with the presence of pain.
Yes.
Not about wiping it out.
No.
But it is about being in relationship with it and also having enough skill to know which pain needs to be dealt with and which pain doesn't.
Yes.
Yeah.
But also to, like Frank, I've mentioned this a lot. Frank Ostateski calls it courageous vulnerability.
Yeah, it is. Thank you, Liz.
You're welcome.
Bowman, how are you?
Yeah, very good. Thanks. Cherie had wanted to share.
Oh, Cherie, please.
Heidi, there's something that I have to thank you for.
Okay.
So on my email, at the end of the email, sometimes there's a little blurb that people write, a little saying. And I want you to know what mine has said for about a year because of you.
Oh.
Ultimately, we have just one moral duty: to reclaim large areas of peace in ourselves, more and more peace, and to reflect it towards others. And the more peace there is in us, the more peace there will be in our troubled world. And I want you to know that has manifested itself in my life in the past year in some pretty huge ways.
Wow. Oh, I have chills, Sheree. That's
Thank
such a big deal, you know, and like in all of everything that we share, it is impossible to know what lands for another person. This is what I mean when I said it really matters what we do, because a little piece of a gem that came from Eddie Hillison in the 1940s made it to us. Made it to us, and whatever it's doing for you in your life and what it's doing for me or anybody else is a big deal. This is what we're talking about when we talk about anatta, right? Not self. We put these things out and let them go and understand that I take that seriously about cultivating the peace. I don't know how that's going to land for anybody else, but I trust it. I'm so glad you told me this.
My sister and I have not spoken to each other in over 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And I just spent 4 days with her in Nashville, Tennessee. And
wow.
Fantastic. And it's because of that. Cultivating the peace and the relationship was the priority.
And you knew it. Right. So to give yourself credit to say, this was the priority.
Yes.
This is the priority. That kind of healing is so deep, and I don't think it unheals. Right? I think you can trust it, that if the two of you are able to do that after 10 years, that's love.
Yeah.
And that's what this practice is really about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, Sheree, I'm very happy for you. That's so beautiful. Thank you. Who else? How are we doing on time? Oh, okay. Marion, hello there. Go ahead and unmute. There you go.
Just wanted to say hello. And I'm going to be in that class that you're having tomorrow.
Good.
And I'm also, I'm progressively getting worse. So I'm not hardly really walking.
Wow.
And I'm doing the best I can.
And you're here, right? Look at your commitment to your heart. You're showing up.
Yeah.
You show up and play the bagpipes. That's what we do. We show up and play what we can.
Never heard that.
So the class that Marion is talking about, I'll tell you about. I'm offering a 4-week series on the practice of the Bodhisattva. And you can go to my website if you're interested, or I can try to pull it up really quickly. I don't want to take too much time here. If you just go to pacificmindfulness.com to online classes, it starts tomorrow afternoon. It's from 4 to 5:30 Pacific time. The next 4 Mondays, it's called Walking the Path of the Bodhisattva, Caring for Ourselves, Each Other, and the Natural World. And we're just going to explore what does it mean to show up. And just an hour and a half. Come if you like. Check it out. I want to end with another poem, of course. This is called Big Lesson from Rosemary Wattola Traumer. Today, it feels so simple. We are here to take care of each other. How could we ever forget? As if soil could forget it is here to feed the trees. As if trees could forget they are here to feed the soil. How could anything ever get in the way of generosity? How could we ever greet each other with any words besides, "How can I help you?" As if light could forget it is here to help illuminate. As if dark could forget it is here to help us heal. So we offer up the goodness of our practice to know that it really matters. We offer it up in support of our own hearts, our own pain, that it will change, sometimes worse, sometimes better, sometimes sideways. But we offer up the benefits, the efforts that we make for our own well-being and for the well-being of each other, all of our kin, and beyond, everyone. Human and non-human world, those especially who are living with the threat of violence, may the violence end soon. May we all be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering.